It's the Truepenny Show with your host, James Truepenny.
Hello and welcome to the Truepenny Show. My name is James Truepenny. This is my show, and today we are going back in time to 1990 and to AJW, a place I love dearly and a company that was massively influential around the world. And that influence is starting to show in the mainstream once again as Bull Nakano will go into the WWE Hall of Fame in a couple of weeks' time. So I wanted to go back and review a show. Now, me and John Dinsdale are going to do a full Bull Nakano career retrospective, as you would expect on such occasions soon. But I wanted to look at Bull Nakano in context. And the man who chose to come and join me is Martin from the Wrestling Rewind. How are you doing, sir?
How's things, James?
Well, very well. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to join us.
No, you're very welcome. I mean, I do have something of a bone to pick with you because I work a fairly rigorous schedule and I have, you know, my partner and family and all that. And I just about get time to watch Dynamite and Collision, and if I'm lucky, I'll get a wee bit of Ring of Honor, and I have to make time to watch pay-per-views. Like, I have to book time off work and that. So I'm fairly blocked up. But now, because of you, I have to somehow invent the time to watch 1990s All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, because I'm suddenly a massive fan of it now.
There you go. Every time we do this, we had Dara on, and we were doing the review that Tsuki Mito is on this show because I found her retirement show, and Dara was like, oh my god, this is amazing.
It's incredible. And like, coming from someone who has, you know, very limited experience of Japanese wrestling, you know, like I was saying, the big New Japan shows and maybe occasional matches that I've heard about, and some of Lunder Blaze and Bull Nakano's kind of 90s feud, that would be the limit of my exposure. So I was kind of going into this cold, and I was blown away, like legitimately blown away by this. I do apologize ahead of time, however, if I do get maybe some of the names or pronunciations or whatever,
that's fine. We quite understand. We welcome, you know, people trying, which is the main thing. That's the whole thing. You come to embrace it, so we'll embrace you.
Very good.
So, where are we? Well, we're at AJW Wrestle Marine Piad 1990. For those of you who don't know, Yokohama has a marina. So, AJW called their show Wrestle Marina Piad.
Oh, I was, yeah, so it's some sort of pun. I was wondering what that was.
Yes, Yokohama Bunker Gymnasium is right on the dock.
So, they're going to wrestle Marines in a piad.
No, not quite that bad. But yes, this was a sellout crowd, 6,200. And the show opened with a Japanese Tag Team Championship match. Now, for those of you who are unaware of the AJW title ranking system, the Japanese Tag Team titles were the secondary Tag Team titles in AJW. And the champions at the time were Kaoru Mida, and also Kaoru Mida and Mika Takahashi, the Honey Wings. Now, Kaoru Mida is one of our favorites here at the Truepenny Show. Remarkably, she only retired a couple of years ago and still at the age of like 51 had the best looking moonsault in pro wrestling. But defeating them were Itsuki Mita and Mima Shimoda, not quite the LCO yet, but definitely showing the ability that would make them, in my humble opinion, the greatest tag team of all time. That's a big statement to say, but I stand by it. Because I know what they're capable of.
Well, I could see why, and like, not to make myself out to be some sort of expert after having viewed one match ever. but this was the match that instantly brought me into this show. Like, I was within 5 minutes fully invested in this. And it's largely down to the kind of hyper-aggressive style of both teams and the vicious looking submissions, just terrifying. Like, I think I'm not sure who it was, but one of them was caught in just the most medieval torture looking submission move, and all I could think of was that is either the most flexible woman in the world or she is in legitimate incredible pain.
Takahashi was pretty flexible, Maeda was flexible too, and Mita and Shimoda, though they were baby faces at this point, would be the biggest, baddest heels in pro wrestling as they got further into the early 2000s. I've said it once and I'll say it again. The LCO would have made the Dudley boys, well, they would have taken the Dudley boys' lunch money and made them cry.
Do you know what? I could see some of that working out. It's great when you're watching Japanese wrestling with no, like, there's no English in this. There's no dubbed commentary or anything. And it you learn actually a lot about promos, because I was kind of more or less able to follow the story even without understanding any of the words, just from the tone and the body language. And then obviously when they physically attack each other, that's a big hint as to how they're feeling.
AJW going with their usual 7-person team on commentary. I don't know how you felt about that.
Do you know what it was? I liked it because I obviously didn't have a clue what they were saying, but it felt like it fit the moment. So
yes.
I wasn't listening to it intently. It was kind of background jabber, but because it was in Japanese, it really suited what was happening on screen. And also, you know, I grew up in an era where I learned to tune out Michael Cole, so immune to this.
Yes. You don't know, but Itsuki Mita would go on to be the person that invented the Death Valley Driver.
Wow. That's mad, because one of the, and I don't think it was her, but later on I have one in my notes about one of them using a finishing move that looks like a mix between a power slam and a Death Valley Driver. But, so it was Itsuki Mita who invented that.
She invented the Death Valley Driver. Yeah.
I wonder who her, you know, her training partner was when she said, "I have an idea. Come here.
Well,
shoulders here."
Her dojo class was Mima Shimoda, who's in this match, Kairu Mida, who's in the match with them, Bat Yoshinaga, who's in the next match but wasn't on the tape, Takoko Inoue, who's in the next match and the match after that but wasn't on this tape, Medusa Maselli, Alundra Blaze, was also in that dojo class, though she was only a visitor, Bison Kimura was in that class, Yumiki Hata was in that class, and Suzuki Minami and Akira Hokuto were in that class.
There's just
and Kyoko Inoue. So literally everybody on this card that you see was in that class of wrestling, was in that dojo class.
There's just kind of a moments in time, isn't there, when certain people sort of gather at the right place at the right time, and it just makes something incredible.
And bear in mind that Combat Toyota and Megumi Kudo, who would be FMW's twin aces in their women's division, that could sell out Yokohama Arena with 15,000 people by themselves, not with the men, on their own in the headline slot, weren't considered good enough to work for AJW. They got dropped.
Wow. But I actually have in my notes further on, particularly around the Medusa match, that watching her, she is miles and miles ahead of, you know, pretty much anything that was happening in women's wrestling in the West.
Yeah.
But in that ring with those other three women, she's still a half step behind them. It's unbelievable the level of skill, intensity, the authenticity with which these look like fights play out. But there's obviously such a huge level of skill in them, because after it, people are getting up and walking out. Nobody's been carted out of there or
out. Super smooth, absolutely. It's pure pro wrestling. It was there was lots of injuries because it was hyper aggressive. And then when you have, that was the class of 1986, the class of 87 was arguably better. Minami Toyota, Toshiya Yamada, Takoko Inoue. You know, some incredible stars in that class as well. And when you've got, essentially, I always describe it as you've got the 10, arguably 10 of the best wrestlers who ever lived and would be in the top 50 in most, if you were doing an objective list of greatest in-ring performers, they would all make the top 50 of male and female. And there's 3 or 4 of them who are the best ever. And you put them all in one company. and all press go.
No, it's tremendous. It's also, it wasn't even just like the really aggressive hard hitting style was kind of what caught me at first. You know, it was kind of made me go, whoa, let's watch this. But it was, I think what kept me going was just all the little touches through it. Like whenever they're doing a top rope move, their partner will hold the other person in place. So it's not just the case of, you know, you lying there like a gormless Egypt or standing around waiting for someone to jump down on you. There was just all like little touches like that that just really impressed me right from the start.
You will probably not be surprised to learn that Mima Shimoda is still active in the wrestling industry. She works in New Japan Pro Wrestling as kind of like an on-the-spot advisor and producer.
Oh, yeah, I like these strike me as the type of people who live forever. Like we had Aja Kong in AEW in 2021, I think.
Yeah.
They all come from the school of Terry Funk.
Oh, yeah. Terry Funk actually thought this company was 5 years ahead of his time. He was one of the first to recognize how good they were.
Oh, definitely. Like, again, from a purely Western perspective, you're looking at this going, it's 20 years ahead of its time. Like,
Kenny Omega and Kota Ibushi say these are the people that inspired us. We didn't want to be as good as Flair and Steamboat. We wanted to be good as Manami Toyota and Aja Kong.
Yeah, you very, very quickly when you're watching this, you stop watching women's wrestling and you're just watching it's just wrestling. They're incredible performers.
Absolutely. Mima Shimoda as well is, I was saying, is on the spot producer. She kind of made Jay White Jay White. She was a lot of advice to him as he was growing up in the company. He's pointed out that at several occasions. She's a manager in CMLL as well. She managed, I can't remember the name. This guy who works for CMLL, he's a Japanese wrestler who works in Mexico all the time. And he kind of looks after the young guys that go on excursion to CMLL. So Hiromu Takahashi and Yo and Sho were part of a Japanese kind of heel faction in CMLL. And she was managing them when they were there. So she's kind of a big player in Japanese wrestling in general still. And Kairi Miida was the one that broke the mold. She was the first to... She went off to an excursion to CMLL and just didn't come back.
But it is, you can see very quickly there is a level of talent here that is...
Yeah.
It's generational, not just in terms of, you know, how incredibly just natural and smooth they are in the ring. You know, like that will obviously help later on down the line when it comes to bringing up other people in the industry.
Definitely. Now, not on the tape, which tagged into this tweeted show and you and the on the socials, as it were, Bat Yoshinaga and Kei Arita went to a draw. If you go back to the shows that me and Chelsea did, Bat Yoshinaga was the AJW Mixed Martial Arts Champion and seemed to be fighting Kei Arita on a weekly basis at one point. So I'm pretty sure that Ito's face got flattened by Yoshinaga on a regular basis. I'm sure she looked different when she retired. But yeah.
So there's a couple of matches on... So the feed I watched, it didn't have a few of these matches.
No, it didn't have this one, no.
But at the end of it, they did a kind of a, you know, thanks for watching, highlights compilation of all the matches over the evening. So some of the matches came up in this, and I was like, oh, what happened there? How did I not see that? But is this MMA or kickboxing or whatever they're doing?
It was semi-shoot. There was a predetermined ending to it, but how they got to that, you've got three rounds go kind of thing.
Yeah.
There was a British stand-up comedian and former wrestler who described it and said, wrestling's fixed, it's not faked. Because if someone asked you to go nine rounds with Mike Tyson, if someone asked you to fight Mike Tyson, but don't worry, you go down in the 10th, you'd be rightly concerned about the previous nine rounds.
So take it then, yeah, it is.
Yes.
Go out and fight for three rounds, but don't accidentally win.
Yes, don't murder each other. That was kind of the basis behind all shoot fighting of that era. UWFI worked on a similar process as well. So it was kind of in that era. And it was kind of like just trying to, the guys were doing it, and the guys had such a massive influence on Joshi. Like Akira Hokuto was named after Akira Maeda, you know. So it's the kind of, you know, there was an influence back and forth between the men's game and the women's wrestling. You know, later on, it's in that match, you look at like Atsuki Mita's figure four. It's just, well, yes. No, it's not Atsuki Mita's figure four, is it? It's Minami Toyota's figure four. It's just stunning. Just gorgeous to watch.
That was another match where the submissions were just brutal. Yeah. Really cinched in and looked like legitimate locks, like legitimate holds. Like, how would you get out? You're looking at it going, my God, how would you get out of that?
Yeah. And a lot of it came down to the organization was highly influenced by Mildred Burke, who was, of course, a proper shooter back in the 1950s. She had to carry the NWA Heavyweight Championship and had to be able to defend herself because everyone in the NWA hated her. Which, you know, she got double-crossed out of the title back in the 50s, so she learned she was a proper shooter.
Was she the original kind of screw job?
Yeah, basically what happened was her husband, as things go, her husband was a wrestling promoter. Tell me if you've heard this story before. Mildred was a bank clerk or something. I can't remember the exact story, but she wanted to try out for wrestling, and she went to his gym and told one of the guy wrestlers, slam her, and she'll go away. But she slammed him. And then, so he realized he had something good on his hands and started to promote her and taught her how to wrestle. And she was a massive draw, especially during Second World War, because obviously there was no men around. So she became this massive, massive draw as NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. But eventually they fell out and got divorced. And, of course, the NWA, being no women allowed at the time, they sided with her husband. And she was promoting herself, but they wouldn't allow her to promote herself. They had to go through him to get NWA bookings. So she founded the Women's Wrestling Association in California, which was kind of outside of the NWA's auspices because of, like, Roy Scheider kind of dropping out of the NWA. And it was kind of a no-go territory for the NWA, so they kind of left to be. And she ran that promotion for a few years. And then in the 60s, when the Matsunaga brothers wanted to start AJW, they invited her over to see what they were doing. She gave it their blessing, and they licensed the WWWA Championship, which is what you see defended later on this show, to them. And that's how that started. But essentially, she kind of named herself champion because she was technically undefeated, but she lost, basically... She was wrestling somebody somewhere and she lost the first ball and what turned out to be a bit of a shoot fight. And then the referee called for curfew because the building was going to close, and she lost the title because she'd lost the first ball. But the NWA rules at the time said you had to lose two falls to lose a championship.
Right. Because I was wondering if this was where they got the idea for the original, was it the Fabulous Moolah and Wendy Richter?
Yeah, that was very much a similar kind of situation.
Yeah, yeah, which then obviously inspired the 1987 Bret Hart one.
Yes. Oh, and Moolah was a piece of work. She was horrible.
Bull Nakan was going in and Moolah's coming out.
Moolah cost Jumping Bomb Angels were supposed to be WrestleMania 4 to defend the titles against Debbie Coombs and Leilani Kai. But Leilani Kai and Debbie Coombs were the tag team champions at the time. And they were told, don't drop the titles in Japan. And all right then. But then Mueller called them and said, oh, no, you're dropping the titles to the Bomb Angels in Japan on this big AJW card. And they were like, okay. But they were trying to get hold of Pat Patterson to check. And they couldn't get hold of Pat Patterson to check because he was in charge of booking the women's matches at the time. They dropped the titles to the Bomb Angels. And when they got back to America, they were like, what are you doing? Well, you told us to drop them. No, we never said that. And that was the end of that. They didn't get a women's tag team title match at WrestleMania 4 because of Mueller.
But did they jump the Bomb Angels? They did do a few WWF shows, did they?
Yeah, they did. They did. They were massively over in MSG.
Because I remember...
Hogan levels over in MSG.
It was mad because I remember watching... I'd never heard of them, but I remember watching an old VHS and... it was a WWF show. I can't remember which one.
Yeah.
But the Jumping Bomb Angels were on it. And I was like, that's the best name I've ever heard.
Yeah.
And then they started the match. And it was the first time I'd ever seen, top rope power bomb. Not off the top rope, but you know where you set up the power bomb and you bounce them off the top rope and then spin around. It was the first time I'd ever seen that.
That'd be Norio Tateno. She was on this card, but she was on one of the matches that wasn't on the tape. Yeah, they were amazing. And
it's unbelievable the the ingenuity of some of these moves, some of these sequences. Like, it's genuinely incredible stuff.
Absolutely. The next match along was Hypercat, La Diabolica, Mayumi Yamamoto, and Miura Kamiya against Esther Moreno, Norio Tateno of the Jumping Bomb Angels, Takeoki Inoue, and Jyoti Hamada, daughter of Hamada, sister of the other Hamada sister, whose name has completely escaped me. but this was kind of a CMLL Rudos Technicos match that we have. On this one is Marika Yoshida and Yumiki Hotta going up against Medusa Miceli and Bison Kimura of Jungle Jack, which I will explain when we get to the main event because it tells the story a bit better. Medusa Miceli up until this point had been quite the baby face in Japan and was now turning heel to join Jungle Jack. Bison Kimura is freaking Bison Kimura. I love that woman. It's Clint Eastwood with leopard print tights. Anyway, and they went up against Marika Yoshida, who was at the time, again, 1986, she was kind of a rookie and still finding her feet. She would gain later fame as the ace of Arcyon, Rossi Ogawa's first major promotion after he left AJW, when she became much more of a mat stylist and a shooter, and she invented the air raid crash. So Drew McIntyre's finisher.
Oh,
and Yumiki Hotta, who kicks harder than anyone else I've ever seen ever.
Well, that's what I have down here, is that I didn't think this match was maybe not as technically sound as the previous match, but more than made up for it in terms of intensity and the hardest striking I have ever seen. Like, fully either that is the snuggest punching and the snuggest kicking and they're just incredibly skilled, or she is punching that woman. Like, it was...
Like, the absolute intensity of Dyson Kimura just stood on the apron for a start. It's just... she just stands there and she looks terrifying. And
A real aura around... Like, and again, coming in completely cold... Like, these people have had, you know, 2 minutes to make an impression on me, and you already see that there's an aura around them.
Yes, absolutely. And is there anything more 1990 than Medusa Miceli wearing pink Zuma tights and pink monogrammed kick pads and a ripped up t-shirt?
Well, do you know, whenever I first turned the show on, I keep going to say a pay-per-view. I'm not sure if this was a pay-per-view or
It was a bit of a live event. It would have been released on DVD. May have been shown on television at the time, but definitely would have been released on DVD. Oh, well, not DVD. Video disc back then. Which is probably the reason why they cut those matches out to make it into a two-hour show.
Oh,
to keep quality, you see.
Yeah. TNA had an issue with that, putting out really long tapes, but it was like massively reducing the video quality. But it was just when you mentioned that the most 90s thing ever, it was like when it, as soon as I put it on, as soon as it started, is it Maeda and Takahashi, or is it Mita and Shimoda who come out wearing the multicolored Lycra?
No, the workout gear. It's Maeda and Takahashi.
Yeah. I was like, oh my God, that's the most 90s thing ever.
All right, then, let's just move on. So there was also on this particular... Oh, yeah, we were talking about Bison Kimura Medusa himself.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about this match?
No, I'll tell you what happened in this match was happened in a previous match as well, and it was a trend I really liked during the night, was a lot of these matches ending with... a really hard hitting move, or with you know, the tag team partner being held back or something, but not with a really obvious finisher move or signature move, like just a real hard. I think one of them was caught with a rough looking fisherman suplex, and that's something I've always wanted modern day wrestling to do. I love the signature moves, I love the big finishers, you know, that's all great, but I hate when they pull out like a real ingenious, you know, combination or a real ingenious sequence, and then it ends in a kick out. And I'm like, oh no, I would have loved that.
Yes.
Because one, that's genius. You've worked something out there, like sell that. And two, like it gets to the point where whenever someone's setting up for their move, it's kind of it's being telegraphed what's happening, you know. So I really appreciated a lot of the finishes on this show.
I think, I mean, that's kind of coming back with Zack Sabre Jr. and Jonathan Gresham a little bit. I know Gresham was Ring of Honor pure champion. He won every match in his pure run with a different finisher, which is really cool. And Zack has loads of different submission finishers as well, obviously.
Oh, Zack's amazing. So Bryan Danielson does it as well to a lesser extent in AEW. But it's something I love. Like, by all means, have your big finisher, have your signature move. But I love when someone pulls out something real vicious and unexpected. And, you know, that should be the end of it. The other thing I got was I loved Medusa's promo after this match. Just dripping blood, screaming into the camera. and she started it off in Japanese as well. She finished it then in English. I assume she only has a certain amount of Japanese.
Yeah.
But, incredible storytelling through this whole show without the need for, you know, 20-minute promo trains or video packages or anything else.
No, it's all pretty... This is the thing, is like, I think the test of a good wrestling show is you should just be able to watch it and not have anything explained to you. If it's entertaining for 2 hours, then it's a good wrestling show.
Yeah, and like I say, I'm watching this cold without a word of English in the whole thing. So I think it's a real testament to how well the show, as well as the matches, how well the show as a whole was structured.
Yes, very much so. It's you've got the right things in the right paces, even though you're taking like half the matches out. Everything paces nicely. Nothing seems overdone. It's not tiring to watch in any way, shape or form. Now, by modern wrestling show standards, 2 hours isn't particularly very long. But there are AJW shows that are 4 hours long that just don't drag. It's just all go. And partly it's down to that style of just like hell for leather from the bell, which you don't get in Joshi so much anymore, specifically not in Stardom, because it's kind of been influenced to some people's taste a bit too much by New Japan Pro Wrestling. But you certainly get it in Tokyo Joshi Pro Wrestling, where the youngsters still go like hell for leather. It's not quite as anywhere near as intense as this, thankfully, you know, because it did shorten careers. But it's still a thing. It's, you know, you go to a Joshi show, you expect things to happen a certain way, and it's kind of genre expectations. First match is going to have you on the edge of your seat and drag you along for the rest of the show.
Well, so, yeah. it's definitely the feeling I got. Like I said, I sat down kind of half, you know, maybe being a wee bit apprehensive with this, and then the next thing, it was over. Like I was sitting on my couch at, you know, 2 a.m. screaming at the telly.
Well, next up was a match we didn't see. Los Brazos, Brazos de Oro, Brazos de Plata, and El Brazo, which are ace names for luchadors, obviously. They defeated Gran Hamada, who is the father of Zlotti Hamada, Kendo, and Yoshihiro Sai in 14 minutes and 90 seconds. That was for the UWA at World's Trios Championship, which were on loan to this for this particular show. They did occasionally put men's wrestling on these shows.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is it like, would they have one on every mat, every show, or
just occasionally? This is the work of Wally Yamaguchi, I have a feeling. Do you know who Wally Yamaguchi is?
I don't know.
You know the guy who managed Kai and Tai in WWE in the early 90s, who demanded yes. that Val Venis's pee-pee be chopped off for violating his wife?
Yes, I am.
Well, not violating, that's wrong. No,
you don't,
no, let's say. Yes.
You don't quickly forget that kind of thing.
That was Wally Yamaguchi.
Oh, wow.
Now, Wally Yamaguchi wasn't just a high-level manager for WWE. He was friends with Vince McMahon, obviously, because that's how he got the job. But he was also a wrestler, referee, manager, and booker for Michinoku Pro Wrestling. He was heavily involved in the magazine industry in Japan. He was working, I think he was working in a baseball magazine. He was kind of the guy in indie wrestling in Japan. There's a famous match with Akira Hokuto where he was the one only person trusted to blade her, because no one had really done it that much in AJW for quite some time, and he bladed her because he was trusted to do it properly. She trusted him to do it right. And he was one of the guys behind that ridiculous 13 promotion show at the Tokyo Dome. He was one of the guys behind Kai and Tai in WWE, obviously, because he came from Michinoku Pro. He was just amazing, kind of like person that kind of put an awful lot of things together in pro-Japanese wrestling history. And funnily enough, of all people, Dean Allmark, British wrestler, was friends with him because of his time in wrestling in the Indies in Japan in the early 2000s. And Dino sent a very nice tweet to me when he passed away, because I retweeted it, and he was like, oh, thanks for letting me know, because I miss him greatly, and he's such a nice guy. So genuinely one of the nice guys of pro wrestling, who happened to be one of the most influential human beings in pro wrestling history that you don't really hear an awful lot about, even though he was a major on-screen player as well.
It's wild, isn't it, the amount of people who are so involved in the industry, like around the world, not just in Japan,
yeah.
That you don't know about, or that you don't hear, or that your only association with them is, like you say, as a manager for a certain team.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's like, you know, he manages Kai and Tai, but he's also, at the same time, he's booking stuff for FMW. And because of that relationship between WWE and Wally and FMW, that means that eventually you get things like Ken Shamrock versus Big Van Vader in a cage on an FMW show.
That's awesome.
Shawn Michaels refereeing the main event at the FMW 10th anniversary. It's like... Because he was Wally, and everyone liked Wally, so everyone did stuff for Wally.
Was FMW, were they the ones who are kind of known for the death matches?
Yeah. They were the blueprint for ECW.
Exploding ring. They did the
exploding
ring.
The double hell death exploding ring barbed wire matches. Yeah, and yeah, Wally was highly involved in those as well. Probably IWA as well, I would think, as well, some stuff. He was just kind of everywhere. Look at his Wikipedia page, it's like pages and pages, and then he did this, and he did this, and this. It's like ridiculous, man. Ridiculous human being. He was just one of those guys. The whole wrestling industry kind of like revolved around him, but you barely knew who he was.
It's he sounds like one of those bands where someone says, "Oh, you know, I know the Troubadours." No, I've never heard of the Troubadours. You do know them? I don't. I've never heard of them. And then they play a song, and you go, "Oh, I know that song." That song. Well, obviously, I've heard that song. I just didn't know who it was. That's what he sounds like.
Yeah, he's just one of those guys who's just like everywhere. Just, you know. And you look at the people who work for him, and they are everywhere too. Taka Michinoku, still wrestling, wrestles for New Japan Pro Wrestling as a member of Just Five Guys, the manager of Just Five Guys, runs his own promotion because he learned all that stuff from Wally Yamaguchi. You know, it's like. He Just Tap Out is still running shows. If you want to, me and John reviewed some Just Tap Out shows not long ago. You can go find them on their YouTube channel free of charge. They've got a little small roster. They run tiny little shows, and brilliantly, Taka sits in the back live tweeting them as those shows are going on. You can see him on camera. He's got his phone out. He's taking pictures. He's at his match. He sat at the back with the fans, got his phone out, taking pictures and retweeting them. Ace. It's like proper wrestling. That's what I want. You know, what former WWE superstars sat at the back of a church hall somewhere in Osaka. That's what I want.
That's the proper indie work ethic, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Everything. One man show. What more do you need? Give us a ring and all and we'll get the job done. There you go. Anywho, moving on to the semi-main event, Akira Hokuto and Suzuki Minami, your Marine Wolves and WWWA Tag Team Champions, take on Kyoko Inoue and Minami Toyota. In my humble opinion, the greatest professional wrestler who ever walked God's green earth. So a two best out of three falls match for the WWA Tag Team Championships. 22 minutes and 46 seconds, which is a bit short for these kind of matches, believe it or not. And this was breathtakingly good. This just so good. And I'm not a massive fan of Inoue. I think she was really, really great, but she wasn't as great as the people around her, which is the issue for me with her, in the sense of she's great by modern standards. She would fit anywhere at that age, bearing in mind she was, what, 20? She would, well, 19. She would fit in WWE or AEW or Impact perfectly well and be a great wrestler. But amongst this company, she had all the verve and character and charisma, but didn't necessarily have the physical attributes. But of course, who am I to say? She's still wrestling.
But well, it's so weird to say that. Again, you're coming from the perspective of someone who has seen a lot of this. And I like, this was my first kind of time sitting down watching a full Joshi show.
Yeah.
And I thought Minami was, like you say, sensational, just incredible. But yeah, I really liked Kyoko. In fact, I had down here that Kyoko is dressed like a jester, but those suplexes are no joke.
Oh no, she could throw people about.
Oh my god.
Oh yeah.
And one after that, and every time they got up, she had a different type of suplex, like all different styles. I thought it was phenomenal. But yeah, Minami, sensational, just athletic, aggressive, technical, could do the submissions, snug, so snug. This match was incredible. Like you say, 22 minutes, even by modern standards, would be pretty short for a two out of three falls. Flies by in no time.
Absolutely electric. Just absolutely super smooth wrestling, tight wrestling, just... You don't get any better than this. This is as good as it gets in my book. This is women's tag team wrestling in a better... I did say, like, I think... I was thinking about, like, my favorite all-time matches. And they all boil down to best of three full tag team matches. I think it's the perfect format for wrestling. Because you have... Everyone can go for the full length of the match because you get breaks. Yeah. You've got so much storytelling you can do, like, who wins the first fall, who wins the second fall, who wins the third fall. No one, you know, you can go full bore for an hour if you want to, and it doesn't really slow anything down. And I think my all-time favorite wrestling match is Minami Toyota and Toshiyu Yamada, who is refereeing this match, by the way, because she was Toyota's dojo sister, and they were afraid that the referees were being influenced by Hokuto and Minami. That was kind of the story going into the match. So Yoshida was the referee, and when Hokuto gets pinned in the first fall, she clearly had a shoulder off the mat.
Oh, yes, I saw. In fact, it looked like she was almost lifting her head.
Yes, yes, but it was like, Toshio, are you really calling it down the middle there? Really, really.
But see, with a match like this, like in order to have anything to say that isn't just gushing praise, you kind of have to nitpick.
Yeah.
But like there was a number of sequences in this that were just incredible. It was Kyoko, and I'm not sure if it was Minami or Hokuto.
Minami was the person with the longer hair. Hokuto was the person with the shorter hair.
There was an unbelievable sequence of pinning attempts in the roll ups, in the reversals, and but it looked like it didn't have that slightly kind of contrived air that, you know, when you see the indies do it now where the guys end up rolling around the ring or whatever, it looked like two people just really struggling to come out on top. I thought the dives, like the outside the ring, maybe it's because you hadn't seen so many of them during the night. They just had so much more impact. And this was the match I was talking about earlier, where one of the finishes came from it looked like a mix between a power slam and a Death Valley driver. It was terrifying.
That was a Kibihira Kira Hokuto, I'm guessing, because she's the most terrifying human being I've ever come across.
Yes, actually, it is down here. I have it down here. Yeah, savage finish from Akira. Yeah, that's who
she invented the Death Valley bomb, which I'm guessing is what you're describing there.
That must be it. The Death Valley bomb.
Al Snow's snowplow, which he, because he borrowed it off of her and called it the snowplow, which doesn't sound anywhere near as intimidating as the Death Valley bomb. So why did you call it the snowplow, Al? Yeah, running a wrestling school, are we? Okay. Anywho.
No, I love this match. I love the great, like you were saying, the two or three falls is such a such potential for storytelling.
Yeah.
Obviously, I couldn't understand the commentary, but there was a period during this where Kyoko and Minami looked like maybe they weren't quite on the same page.
Yamada was her regular tag team partner. In a way, was more kind of in Nakano's kind of circle. So they weren't. This was a kind of story from Minami Toyota. She went. Esther Marino had. Hokuto and Minami would lose the titles to Jungle Jack. I think he says, looking at the cage match page. Let's find out. I'm trying to remember. Where are we? It's in 97. Now I'm looking 2003. No, gone to back 2005. More further back than that. Where are we? 74. Too far back. 1990. Yes, Hokuto and Minami would lose them to Jungle Jack, so Aja Kong and Bison Kimura.
Right.
And then Toyota would try several times with different partners. I think she tried with them in a way, Esther Marino, and various other people, never got the job done until after she'd had a feud with Toshiya Yamada, a scientific wrestling feud, which ended in a hair versus hair match the following year, because it was for the IWA title. And for some reason, AJW made it a hair versus. That match is insane. Madness. You couldn't believe two people could do those things. And one of the easily the best hair match you've ever seen, but and emotionally draining because it's two dojo sisters and best friends, and one of them's losing their hair, and one of them's winning the IWA championship. Oh. Go.
This is why I was giving out to you at the start. I don't have time. And now I need to catch up on this.
To catch up on 70 years of wrestling. Started in 1969.
If I could just fit the decade of the 90s in, I'll start with that.
How can I put this? You want to? I gotta like say narrow it down. But each time I go back, you need to watch that. Oh no, you need to watch them. You really need to watch from the Lovely Pair onwards. So the Lovely Pair were the first big superstar tag team that came out of AJW in 77.
Yeah.
And if you watch their big matches, you get the idea of where everything kicks off.
I think I'm just going to have to hand in me notice.
I've gone on a YouTube rabbit hole. It may take me some years to come out of this. James told me to start in 1976.
That's the trimmed down version. I'll tell you what else I appreciated about this was at the end when they got the title, they were also awarded with trophies. I love that Japanese tradition of having tournaments and trophies. It's something I would love to see more in Western wrestling, like the Continental Classic, for example, was sensational. But instead of being a belt, I wish that had just been a trophy, and you win it and you get your name on it, and you're the Continental Classic winner until the next year. yes. You know, rather than it being a belt thing. So I love the Japanese tradition of trophies, you know, for like this match, for G1 and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think the cool, my favorite, all-time favorite was the massive globe you got when you won the Triple Crown.
Oh, class.
You won all three belts, and then there was the massive globe that would be stood beside you when you won the championship. And it's like, that's amazing. Like, what cogs were wearing in Giant Baba's mind? You know what we need? Big fucking globe. That'll do the job.
And the whole thing was Eddie Kingston's continental win was a tribute to the Triple Crown. So yes. where the hell's my updated massive globe?
We want a massive... Tony, what are you doing? Where's the massive globe? You're not doing it right. We need a massive globe.
But yeah, I mean, what more can you say about that? It was just, it was sensational, and then the main event happened. So this show just keeps piling up.
It's like, yeah, any modern booker would say, we've got to have a rest break, we've got a comedy match in here, something light, stick something in, put the rookies on, do something not quite so intense as four of the youngest wrestlers and biggest stars on the roster beating the living shit out of one another. Should we have a break? No!
No, more!
Give me more! This is it. And it's like, you know, Hokuto by herself is the scariest woman that ever lived. She's wrestling injured here, because of course she is. She was known as the mummy because of the amount of ratchets she had where she was taped up. And my favorite was a few years later, she's wrestling Aja Kong for the title and grabs the house mic before the match starts and says, Aja, I just want you to know that I would not like to wrestle for the WWWA championship this evening. I have a knee injury and I do not wish to ruin the prestige of the championship. And then they went hell for leather for 25 minutes in a non-title match.
And Aja cut
a backstage promo whilst they were injecting cortisone into her knee.
And Aja doesn't strike me as the type who, you know, pulls or punches or would have a lot of sympathy for your dodgy knee.
I appreciate what you're saying, Akira. You can have a championship shot when your injury is free, and let's go.
But this evening, I will be exclusively kicking you in the knee.
This evening, you will be taking your ass kicking. Yes, it's just absolutely brutal. So here we get to the WWA World Championship match. Your then champion, Bull Nakano, going up against Aja Kong in a cage. What more could you want in life? Really, really, this is it. This is the whole enchilada, if you will. To give you the background to this story, Bull Nakano was part of the Villainous Alliance, which is the best name for a heel unit ever.
I thought that was you editorializing.
No, they were called the Villainous Alliance. Their name, the Villainous Alliance.
I thought they were just the Alliance and you were...
No. They were the Villainous Alliance. That was
awesome.
Dun Masamoto, Kondo Sato, Crane Yu, Nobuyuki Kimura, Erika Shishodo, who would be Aja Kong, and Yasuke Ishiguro. And when Dump Matsumoto retired and she took over the leadership of the Villainous Alliance, she renamed it Gokumonto and turned it into a face unit and picked up Kyoko Inoue, Tamaki Watanabe, Bat Yoshinaga. And as the team, who were all baby faces, and Aja was not happy. She did not like this. So she started her own organization called Jungle Jack, which was her, Bull Nakano, and Medusa Miceli, who were cornering her in this match. This is an escape the cage match, just like WWE rules, which I'm usually not that keen on because it seems a bit like the baby face is running away from the heel. Yeah. However, when they do it like this...
even just the visual of these two, like, you know, these are big, strong women. Even just the visual of them climbing the cage is impressive.
It's just madness. It is just, you forget how, like, they're obviously, but the intensity that they go at each other with and the selling that they do, it's not just that they're hitting each other hard. They are hitting each other really hard. but it's the amount of selling that goes into it, and it's one of those occasions where it is just like, oh, just hit me as hard as you can, it'll look better, kind of things, which you see in wrestling from time to time. The only trouble was these two were doing it all the time because they were trying to get Arja over and they were trying to get her over as champion, and they were trying to sell tickets at the same time, and it worked.
Well, I was sold on this match before it even started. There's a kind of a brief interview before they come out, and like even that's incredibly intense. Screaming at each other, like the commentators and security and everything's trying to keep them apart. The only thing in it is, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Incredibles. Yeah, but the superhero family, and they have a designer. Yeah. They're trying to design, you know, what their outfit should be, and one of them suggests a cape, and the designer goes, "No, you never use a cape. They always get you in trouble." And Bull kind of proves that here. In the middle of her fight, she slips on the cape a wee bit. But otherwise, this was like, even before they'd come out to the ring, I was already wholeheartedly invested in this.
You've got to love someone who comes to the ring barefoot wearing a Napalm Death t-shirt on you.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even realize she was barefoot until she starts climbing the cage by jamming her toes between the segments.
She just did not give a fuck. Absolutely did not.
A lunatic. And they come out, and so this starts before they even get in the cage. They start battering each other in the aisle during their entrances, fighting through the crowd. And then when I say fighting through the crowd, I don't mean like now when the fight through the crowd where, you know, they go up through the, you know, the walkways in the crowd, like between the seats. No, they're fighting through the crowd. They're getting thrown into the seats through the, like, it's mayhem.
There's no young girls there stopping, asking politely for the crowd to get out of the way either.
No.
It's take Bull Nakano home night. In Yokohama.
6,000 people had to sign a waiver before entering the building.
If Arja Kong lands on you, we will not be covering any medical expenses.
Or funeral arrangements.
It's just so brutal. Just so, so brutal. And
But not to give the impression that it's like a kind of a slap fest either, with them just hitting each other with stuff. Like Nakano is so unbelievably athletic, like incredibly athletic. The kicks she's throwing out, and while it is like strike heavy, and you know they're using the cage a lot and weapons and that, when they do pull out like the big bombs, the big pile drivers, the big power bombs, the big suplexes, like it feels enormous, like it feels like the room shaking.
Yeah, like the there's a sequence that Bull does where she goes for a bunch of brain kicks off the ropes, and she does one straight to the back. She does an axe kick straight to the back of Arja's head, and then she does a spinning axe kick off the middle rope. And it's like, she's 230 pounds, how's she doing that?
Just phenomenally athletic. And that's before we even mentioned the finish, which is
We've got a roller coaster ride of other stuff to get through first, because Medusa Miceli manages to get hold of some railing from somewhere, and then Arja is swinging that about like the biggest set of nunchucks in the world.
Oh yeah.
And then Akiyoko in a way finds a chain to give to Bull, and Bull strangles Arja with it over the top rope.
It tries to tie her to the ropes at one stage to escape. Yeah.
And then Kyoko manages to find some scissors to hand to Bull, who proceeds to slice and dice Arja's arm.
And was very determined to get some juice with that.
Like, oh, yeah.
See where she's like jabbing and then checking and then go, no.
That's some of the crack at this.
A wee bit more.
Yeah, just...
I loved as well, and I don't know if this was a production choice or if it was just they didn't have the cameras to follow it, but I loved that the action stayed focused on the ring, or that the cameras stayed focused on the ring, but outside and around it, you would just get these glimpses of the two factions battering the life out of each other.
Oh, God.
And it was just happening, like if it was happening now, if it was in modern TV now, they'd have a cameraman following that and cutting back and forth. Yeah. But I just loved that they were in the ring killing each other. And then occasionally in the background, you just see like Medusa go flying across the cage.
Because the only time I can, it reminded me so much of the greatest war games of all, which was the Dangerous Alliance versus Stinger Squadron at War Games 93. And Maselli walking across the top of the cage, like trying to drop things to rip through the cage as extra weapons and stuff. It was like, I know where you wouldn't have to do that.
I also loved where the sequences were Nakano's on top of the cage and she's trying to climb out and just Medusa's down there with the rail and just jabbing her in the face. it was phenomenal.
And then we get to the ridiculous finish.
Just how she does this without breaking her coccyx, a hip. It's incredible.
For those of you who have not seen this match, and you can go watch it now, Bull Nakano gets to the top of the cage and gives her leg drop, which is arguably the best leg drop in wrestling history, not from the top rope, from the top of the cage, and bounces to her feet.
And there is no, like, you know, sometimes people, like Matt Hardy and that, would pull out the leg drop, they tend to tilt back, so by the time they actually land, they're kind of taking more of a flat back bump than a leg drop. No, Nakano full on leaps off the cage and leg drops into the ring. It's sensational.
Yeah, absolutely. She did it. She had, I'm not sure she did it against Kandori, which was, there's three of her the three most famous cage matches she had was against Shinobu Kandori in LLPW and against Hikaru Hokuto, which was the next match in her championship defenses, I think, or at least a couple of matches down the line, because we have a promo at the end of this match which sets out the story for AJW for like the next year. And she did it against Hokuto. That was the first time I saw it, and Hokuto moved.
Oh. But do you know what? It's such a risky move that I imagine, like, it's much of a muchness whether...
Yeah.
Like in real life terms, it's much of a muchness whether they move or not. It's like, it's an incredible bump to take.
It is, and it is just, it's. But the fact that she just dropped like 15 feet, landed on her ass, and then bounced up and walked to the next corner and climbed up the top of the cage.
There's a, so after the match, like you say, they have there's like a promo kind of battle between them, and then it breaks in into a brawl. But there's a scene towards the very end, before the seven-man commentary team does their wrap-up. There's a scene towards the very end where I'm after watching Bull Nakano do this insane jump, and she's in the door of the cage, and she's looking out to the crowd. And I think Japanese crowds are traditionally quite reserved, but like... they just lose it in this match. Like, the crowd is going nuts, and she stood in the doorway of the cage. She's bleeding from her head. She's bleeding from her mouth. Mm. She's got her hands balled into her fists, and the knuckles are bleeding, and she's just screaming out into the crowd. And even though I know it happened 34 years ago, I know it is decades in the past, I was in my living room at 2 a.m. ready to die for that woman. Ready to fight and die for that woman.
She's just... I can't say enough. That promo at the end. I'll tell you the story of what happens a little bit in that promo.
Yeah.
So Nakano picks up in a way, he volunteers to tag with Nakano because Bison Kimura challenges Nakano to a tag match. That tag match ends up being Bison Kimura and Aja Kong versus Kyoko Inoue and Bull Nakano, hair versus hair in a cage.
That's just when you don't have enough gimmicks.
Because then they went back to Yokohama and they sold that place out again. Standing room only.
Not that I want spoilers, but tell me Nakano didn't lose, because her hair is incredible. Her hair is amazing.
You notice that RG Kong's had a crew cut ever since?
Oh, is that a consequence?
Yes. I mean, RG Kong herself, and as much as we heap praise on Bull Nakano, RG Kong, as a mixed race person growing up in Japan, had about the hardest existence anyone in the world's ever had. And then she chose to be a Joshi professional wrestler.
Yeah.
And not only did she become a great wrestler, she became one of the greatest ever wrestlers.
Oh, and yeah. Like you say, she's showed up in AEW just 2 or 3 years ago and could still go. Like,
oh, yeah. Akira Shida and her in 2018 had one of the best matches I've ever seen.
And yeah, we were kind of taken aback by sort of the big stunts Nakano was doing. So yeah, not to take anything away from Aja Kong's role in this incredible match.
It's just insane. Just absolute mental. And then, of course, you get the Marine Wolves. They come down there complaining because Akira's due a match with Bull Nakano, and that's going to hold up the championship reign. Bull Nakano and Okito eventually have a match for the WWA Championship. And then Manami Toyota and Toshi Yamada come and have a go at Marine Wolves. But Bison Kimura and Aja Kong have a go at them because they want to go at the tag team titles as well. And essentially, those eight wrestlers rule the wrestling world for the next 5 years.
Do you know what I got the impression watching it that AJW has maybe a comparatively small roster, but they tell all these stories interconnectedly.
Yeah.
But again, that's just the impression I got from one view, and I could be totally wrong on that.
No, you're right. There's like, there was units like there is in, it wasn't as obvious today, like, you know, there were some named units like Jungle Jack and stuff, but it was unit faction wrestling, which is a traditional Japanese staple, right? Because of sumo, yeah? So in sumo, you have different factions because everyone has a different coach and trains in a different place.
Yeah.
Well, the first big name in Japanese wrestling was Riki Dozan, and he brought that idea with him, and that's where you get factions in wrestling, in Japanese wrestling now. That's why you get Bullet Club and House of Torture and Chaos and LIJ and all those things in New Japan, and good-looking guys, and there aren't that many in Noah at the minute. There used to be loads in Noah. There's about two now. But, you know, I mean, Stardom has five or six as well. You know, so yeah, that yeah. idea
you
of...
see that influence yeah. even into, like, AEW and the likes, like when it first started, it was very heavily faction based.
Yeah, and as well, it's a Bill Watts thing too. You know, Bill Watts used that idea a lot as well. You would have five groups of guys who would wrestle off against five groups of guys until they'd run out, and then they find another five group of guys. They find another five group of guys, and you do that, and you get constant episodic stuff and relationships build organically for the audience. So when somebody does turn heel, it means more.
Yeah.
You know, and this isn't so much about turning face and turning heel, but it is so much about those relationships between the dojo classes and the sisters in the dojo class. And we were tag team partners when we were rookies and all of those things. Because it's like the classic example is Atsuka Mita got separated. Atsuka Mita and Mimi Shimoda got separated the year before. And Mita tagged with Yamada and Shimoda tagged with Manami Toyota, and it was great, but you could tell it didn't work. You know, there was something in the background saying there's no spark here like there was, like there should be.
Yeah.
And then someone had the idea, why don't we put Toyota and Yamada together, because they're good friends, and then they end up being like amazing. And then it's like, all right, well, if we're going to do that then why don't we put Shimoda and Mita together? And then we'll get them to join a group with Hokuto, who was their trainer. That was great. You know, and it's like, it just moves, everything moves along in that way. It's like sometimes you could see where they made missteps and then corrected it.
Class.
And that's what makes it just so interesting to watch from me. When you especially when you watch it retrospectively, you've got and it's such a closed company. They didn't really start working with other people until, well, there wasn't any other Japanese Joshi companies until 92 when JWP started. And then LLPW branched off from JWP because all the shooters said, we don't really want to do this pro wrestling malarkey. we want to do shooty type stuff. Can we do that? And they were like, oh, all right then. So we had one promotion of pro wrestlers and one promotion of shooters. And then...
Japanese pro wrestling is already about as close to shooting as you can get.
And then FMW started a women's division. They were the first company to have a mixed roster. And they picked up Megumi Kudo and Combat Toyota because they'd been dropped by JWA in 89. Well, they started FMW in 89. They'd been dropped in 88. Megumi Kudo was a kindergarten teacher. And Atsushi Nota, Anita went to her kindergarten and asked us to come out of retirement to wrestle for FMW.
Awesome.
She ended up headlining with Shark Tashia the biggest mixed gender card of all time to be headlined by women until the WrestleMania that Ronda, Becky, and Charlotte did.
And again, there you go, another example of wrestling and women's wrestling in the West being so far behind what was happening in Japan.
It was because they were given a chance to go. They could draw.
I just want to mention it briefly, because I know it's going back a wee bit, but there was a moment during the cage match where the lights went out, and I thought, I wonder, is it going to be like a big surprise reveal or something? But it was just obviously an issue in the building with the lighting. But while the lights were out, they tried to let the cameras and let the crowd see the match by... It's obviously two guys with spotlights just pointing the spotlights down at them. And I know that was just like somebody panicking, going, oh my God, the lights are out, quick, do something. But it looked amazing.
Oh, and yeah.
It reminded me of like Godzilla movies or monster movies where you only get glimpses of these two huge creatures like smashing into each other. And so the two guys with the spotlights were like trying to follow them, but they were like obviously wrestling in and out and around and through them. And oh, like even though it was entirely accidental, it was just another thing to add to the mystique and the aura of this just incredible match.
Yeah, just absolutely stunning wrestling match. Just can't say enough about it. Me and Marcus have this thing when we review great stuff. You should just go watch it. We can't say stuff because there's no words to say. I've got it here. Just go watch
it. It's not even 2 hours long and it's on YouTube and it's a really good quality. It's like a really good quality rip of it. It's not like a low definition or, I mean, it's obviously filmed in the 90s, so it is what it is, but it's a really good quality rip of it.
This is the thing as well. They had Sony next door to go get the best stuff all the time. They had the best quality cameras, they had the best quality kit. They were always on the cutting edge of production because they were in Japan and they were making the best stuff. It's partly because you had such a good economic situation in Japan in the 80s and 90s, and it's partly because you have that Japanese work ethic of everyone for the company, which may not be, I'll be honest, is not necessarily great for professional wrestlers, but
or people in general.
However, if you want to see the best wrestling ever done anywhere ever, the stretch from 1983 to around about, well, till the company closed, ran out of business in 2005, but I would say from about 1983 to about 1999, that's what, 17-year run of being the best wrestling company on earth artistically, I would say. And they were really hot between 90, I mean, because you had the Crush Gals as well. You know, the Crush Gals were kind of hot from 83 to 90, they retired in 1990, so you're just coming off of the company losing their three biggest stars, because Matsumoto retired just before they did in 89, and then Crush Gals retired in 1990. Well, officially retired, but they came back. In fact, Chikusawa Nagayo had her very last wrestling match ever. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, say no more. Last night in San Francisco on Marvelous's first US show.
Like, it's obviously just in their blood. But if, like, I would say to people, if you're like me, if you don't have like any kind of background knowledge of this, but you do have just kind of like a vague interest for whatever reason, this show is on YouTube. It's like really decent quality. It's less than 2 hours long. I mean, you can't go wrong with this
Absolutely
show.
Not. It's a really good gateway into the whole Joshi in the 90s thing. Would you like to do more of these, Martin? You seem keen.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I have to type up my resignation letter.
It's all right. I can pick and choose. Where would you like to start?
No, but genuinely, like, I would watch more of this. This, I love this style. I love this type of storytelling, where a lot of the story is told in the ring during the match with, you know, facial expressions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I love this type of production. Like, one of the issues I have with modern WWE is that it's so overproduced. It's far too polished. It doesn't feel like a wrestling show. This, as soon as this starts, this feels like a wrestling show. But yeah, I honestly could not recommend enough that if you have even the vaguest interest in just sheer curiosity, seeing what this is about, I would start here.
There you go. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Trooperny Show today. Martin, where can we find you on the interwebs, sir?
Yeah, well, we have our own show on the Trooperny Network, Wrestling Rewind, myself and Dara, where we do old school wrestling pay-per-views from WWF, WCW, ECW, TNA, and we also cover some of the modern bigger pay-per-views. We don't do a lot of the B shows and that, but obviously we do the likes of WrestleMania, Revolution, All In, stuff like that. You get us there.
You kind of do North America while we do the rest of the world.
That's it. Yeah. Yes. That was kind of what we were limited to growing up in South Armagh. In the 90s, the only wrestling you could get was whatever VHS tapes were in the local library. And would you believe it? Cross McGlenn Community Library did not have a lot of it.
Shocking behavior.
Joshi, AJW.
Did you get Power Slam over there? Magazine.
Yeah, we did. We got Power Slam magazine.
See, I'm just wondering. I'm wondering how Finn Martin's reach got to, how far it did, because we obviously, one of the great pleasures of my life was the fact I got to do a podcast with Finn Martin back in the WrestleTalk days. So that was really cool. But yes, you can find me at Sheriff Lone Star on Twitter and at Sheriff Lone Star TX on Instagram. You can find me on Mastodon at Sheriff Lone Star as well. Not many people do find me at Mastodon, if you can miss. It's a nice quiet corner of the internet where I can be myself, which is terrifying. You can find us on Facebook and Patreon, the Trooperny Show, where you can keep it free forever for everyone. And you can find us, as always, on Discord and on Twitter and on Instagram as Trooperny Show. We shall be back next week. I'm not exactly sure what we're doing. I haven't got that far yet. I need to talk to John and see when he's free.
This is a bit like how we run things on the wrestling.
It is. There is a show every Monday. Every Monday there'll be a show, but it is like trying to organize the show the week before. We've just had a good run because we've just had like the New Japan Cup. So there's been literally shows every other day. That's fine. Me and Christy can talk New Japan for literally hours on end. If you want to go back to listen to our New Japan coverage, myself, Marcus, and Christy did around about 12 hours of podcast. In effect, I think it was longer than most of the tournament matches were, about the New Japan Cup, which is lots of fun. You hear me moaning about House of Torture a lot, and Christy being very positive about everything because she's lovely. And Marcus's wonderful lines of pithy lines of have you heard there's a promotion called Glate in Japan, which Marcus is a big fan of, and he described it as, whilst New Japan is offering me noodles, I'll be eating Wagyu steak for free. So yes, because he does love his glade, which is on YouTube. We do try and give you stuff that you can get free of charge, because no one should pay for their wrestling if they can possibly get away with it.
Definitely my attitude to WWE these days.
But there you go. Well, thank you very much for joining us this week. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye.